Thanks for participating. Once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limark Technical Message here every Sunday night at 8 p.m. If anyone has any questions of a technical nature tonight, please give me your first name and your call sign.
This is Ken, WB2KWC.
And whiskey for the car science section after that.
Okay, yeah, I got you on the list, Wes, after we finish the technical stuff and we move over to science. Ken, you have a question or a topic?
Yes, I do. It concerns leaving a radio in a charger. I've got a few radios that I kind of have around. I mean, everything from a DJ580... which is an Olinco to an MD380 from Titera. And I'm wondering, do I leave them in the charger? Do I leave the charger on? Will there be any discharge through the charger if I turn the charger off, but just leave the radio in the charger as a stand? I'm wondering if there's a diode in there that would keep the current flowing to discharge the battery. Your thoughts, WB2KWC.
Okay, I'll give you my thoughts, and I'll ask anyone out there with experience in the subject to add their two cents. It sort of ultimately, unfortunately, depends upon what kind of circuitry is used by the manufacturer. Smart charging chips have become ubiquitous and cheap as anything. You know, China pops out these chips for pennies rather miraculously. And depending upon the quality and the design of these chipsets, theoretically they will tell you that you could do anything you want, and the safety modes will click in. You can't overcharge it because it has a sensor to sense overcharging. You can't damage it by keeping it on the charger all the time. You can't damage it by turning the power off of the charger base. So theoretically, that's what I've sort of read and sort of been told by manufacturers. I tend to unfortunately follow their advice and leave mine in a charging bay all the time. I have had problems with Apple products due to doing that. I have had a plethora of cell phones that needed their batteries replaced because despite the smart power charging chip, it seemed to overheat the batteries. And one of the problems, if you overcharge a battery for too long, is that the heat causes an expansion, gases, and it can just pop the surface off of an iPhone or such. So my advice probably is that you really shouldn't charge it all the time. I think it's perfectly safe to keep it in the charge base if the charge base is not connected to power. I don't think it bleeds power out. I think it's smart enough not to do that. So words of wisdom, especially from someone who doesn't follow them, is that you can use the charge base, but I wouldn't keep it charging 24/7.
Okay, I thank you for your advice. That's kind of what I've been doing. I guess I'm halfway between leaving them in the charger unpowered and just removing them from the charger. But I don't know, maybe I'll try leaving it in and see what happens.
Yes, Michael.
I promise soon I'm going to learn my call sign enough to say it. I've been involved with batteries. I just recently built a skateboard using 40-18-650s, and I know with cell phones, what they recommend is that the worst, point my own battery as far as life, keep charge, and going below, we'll say, 20%. Usually, like with a cell phone, if you can, they say charge it more than 80, let it go more than 40 below. So 40-80 is the best storage battery. The cathode buffer, when you to charge. Again, because these are batteries to the fullest, I think the batteries are going to suffer by keeping it in that charger and keeping popped up. If you can, try and, about 80% can, and I think your batteries will last long and get more cycles out of them.
Well, I mean, I would agree with you. If the question was you need to store something that has a battery with a charge, do you store it with a full charge, do you store it with no charge, or do you store it with something in the middle, the manufacturers, you know, talk about different things, 40%, 60%. And so theoretically, according to them, that's the best way of storing it. If you ask them about the charger, they'll tell you that it's not the charger that's causing the deterioration of the battery. It's just keeping it at that 100%, because they really have confidence in the charger. I'm not quite sure about that, but I agree with you. If the question was a little bit different and you were storing a device, absolutely positively, you store it about 40 to 60% of its charge, and it'll last a lot longer. People who keep it 100% and then throw it into a drawer and then take it out and 100% and throw it into the drawer, that's a little problematic, a little too obsessive compulsive, so I agree with you. But the problem is these devices that we don't kind of store, that we use every single day, and at least for me, is kind of like, I like to start the day at 100% because, you know, if I start the day and it's 80%, then I'm always concerned, you know, when is it going to drop a wee bit too low to do anything useful?
Bravo Zulu.
Yes, Rich.
With my handy talkie, I was following the 80%, 20% rule, and if you want to drop... Keep on doing that, because what happens when it's at 20% and you want to go to sleep and you put it in the charger, what do you set your clock for 4 a.m. so it's at 80% rather than 100%? It's nearly impossible to keep, you know, to be vigilant over that way of charging. But one thing I do know is that the manufacturers, all of them say, never hit the push to talk button when it's in the charger. I don't know exactly why they say it, what's the reason, but I know they all say it. Back to them.
My understanding is it screws up either the regulation of the charge chip or there's back current that goes on. Yeah, that's a kind of universal concept. But, yeah, it's understandable. Sometimes you simply can't time things so that you could pull it out of the charger when it's 80%. Now, there are some devices. My Lenovo tablet, you can actually, and my laptop, you can actually set it for a certain amount of charge, and it's smart enough that if you set it for, say, 85%, I think mine is set for about 80%, if you set it for 80%, it'll stop charging. You don't have to get an alarm clock and lose sleep.
KC2VAW, no traffic.
Okay, Curtis recognized, no traffic.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Have the Allego, the DJ500, and they tell you don't even leave it on when it's in the charger, never mind hitting the push to talk button. They don't even want the thing on. So that's what I do. What I think they should include on these charges is an on-off button. Can you imagine reach down under the desk trying to unplug these things every time you want to leave it in the stand and you have to unplug it, you know, that would drive you crazy too. I've made little wooden stands of mine, you know, with little vinyl backing, you know, where you could click, you know, they all have the belt clips on it. I click it on that and make my own wooden stand. Back to you.
Yeah, I've printed out stands using my 3D printer. They work very nicely. They're not quite as weighted as I would like them. I could probably simply put in weights at the, you know, inside the base of them and get that done. I think the reason why some manufacturers don't want you to even run the receiver is because they don't trust the filtration of the power supply. So they're figuring that there's going to be a little ripple that's going to lead people to be annoyed and complain. And so they just say, yeah, we advise you not to do that at all. I mean, I have a Linko 687. And I have it on the charger, and I have the thing turned on, and it feeds into a PC audio, and it works fine. I don't have any problems with it, but, you know, I can understand why they want to cover their surfaces. Okay, any other comments along this line, or any other technical radio-related questions or topics? Available, just give us your name and call sign.
George, KE2VCQ.
Yes, George, how are you tonight?
Right, I'm okay, thanks. How you doing?
I'm doing fine.
Question. I actually have a couple of questions. I don't know if we can get to them all. I don't know if it really even matters. One question I have is if I'm using an HF radio and I get an automatic tuner and attach it to that, do I really need an antenna analyzer, or is that being redundant at that point?
No. They serve pretty much different circumstances. What you're doing with an antenna analyzer is to optimize the resonance of your radiating antenna. In a perfect world, if you could have it at a decent 1:1, 1:1.2, 1:1.3 without introducing antenna tuners, that would be a sweet thing. If you can't, then once you've gotten it as best you could with your antenna analyzer, better known usually as a vector network analyzer, then you're stuck with putting band-aids on an open wound. That's what antenna tuners are for. They'll take a not exactly resonant radiating antenna, and by the magic of impedance matching, they will twist and turn that phase so that it's acceptable to your transmitter and gets most of your signal radiated out of your antenna. So the two of them are both useful, but they are not, one does not negate the other.
Okay, so the difference then, if I have an SW meter, how do I use that with an antenna analyzer? And the reason I'm asking is I'm very limited with what I can do with antennas here, so as far as adjusting them or anything, I really can't. Where they go, they go. I can't really move them higher, lower, move them around, or anything else. So other than an SW meter, does the analyzer, it's going to help me tune it, but I'm going to tune it by trimming the length of it?
Yeah, it's kind of like going from one dimension to two or three dimensions. It gives you more information. A standing wave ratio meter usually runs simply by having a directional coupler. It reads the power going forward, the power going getting reflected back at you because of a high standing wave ratio, and it then calculates and displays your standing wave ratio. The closer it is to 1:1, the better you like it, although there are other factors that go into an antenna. The efficiency of the antenna, the takeoff angle, the radiation pattern, all of those have very little to nothing to do with the impedance and therefore the standing wave ratio. So, it'll give you a good indication if it's doing decent or doing terrible. The use of an antenna analyzer gives you a much fuller idea of why it's not quite doing so well. If you because you can't take a sweep with a SWR meter. You set up your transmitter at a certain frequency, you key it up with either CW or AM or FM. You can't do it single sideband because you need an audio signal to have output, and you see what the standing wave ratio is, and if it says 6-1, then you got big problems, and that's all you know. If you take an antenna analyzer and you sweep the entirety of, say, 40 meters, you can see that do you have a dip somewhere in 40 meters? That's good. How low does the dip get? Well, it only gets to 4-1. Well, that's not good. So there's something wrong with that design. So it gives you a lot more information that you don't get with a standard SWR meter on your transmitter.
And for something like that, I should use a nano VNA. I saw a couple people recommended that to me. Is that what you're talking about? I could use that to analyze the antenna?
Yes, indeed. A nano VNA is a good expense, in my humble opinion. Some people don't like it. One of the things someone mentioned that they weren't keen about is that it has a built-in lithium battery, and you know, it's not easily exchangeable. You can't just pop it out and put another one in. But you know, for $50 to $80, I don't know. I think it's worth it personally. But you know, some people don't want more information. They want to keep it simple. They want to keep it short. Is it good or is it bad? That's all. They don't want to really worry about why it's going wrong. But I like to know why, and I run VNA scans on pretty much all of my antennas repeatedly, year in and year out, to see if things have gone wonky with them. And to me, it's very informative. I mean, a lot of times I'm not going to change it because the alterations are minuscule. But it gives you a far better idea whether you're going in the right direction or in a terrible direction. And you know, you just kind of fooling yourself that you have a dummy load instead of a good radiating antenna.
Okay, that's an excellent answer. Another question that I have is, I guess with high-frequency radio waves, the 10, the 20, the 40 meter, how well do they penetrate buildings? The reason for this question is, I don't know if you've heard me talking about building an antenna being in a co-op with an HOA. I was actually able to build a 40-meter dipole by building it in a PVC pipe, putting the two connectors on a PL239, and now the elements run out like 32.8 feet. I looked for a design for one for 7.150. The frequency is 7.150. I was able to find that I can lift up the vinyl siding shingles and tuck the wire up underneath them, so I have the elements running horizontally out from the center of my apartment towards the other apartments. The question is, I can't really do anything with that. It has to be there. How bad is the building that it's right up against? How bad is that going to affect my the field that I'm generating?
Well, it's going to have an effect, and especially it sort of depends upon the structure of it. If it's more brick and cement, it's going to be less problematic than if there's a lot of metal that goes into the shell of the building. You know, it's not a perfect situation, but we don't live in perfect situations. So you use what you got available to you, and, you know, sometimes it works out and sometimes it doesn't. You might end up having a significant directionality that either suits you or doesn't suit you. But if that's where the life has planted you, you don't have that much of a choice.
My problem is if I have directionality, I face east. So I'm going to be looking to talk to people in the middle of the ocean or Europe. And I'm really looking. I think, actually, I'm able to get into Nassau County and the Queens border using a diamond on UHF, VHF, using a diamond X30A. That's just right off my apartment. So I'm able to transmit east with that. I understand that the high frequencies penetrate buildings better than the VHF and the UHF frequencies. Am I correct with that?
AC2GS, by the way. Yes, but unfortunately, like most things, the next line is it's complicated. As you go into shorter and shorter frequencies, the ability to kind of penetrate through objects becomes a bit better and bit better, but also the free space loss, just the attenuation of the signal just in open space becomes higher. So that's why I think we mentioned a couple of episodes ago that the 5G uses very, very short microwaves, and because of that free space loss, they require a lot more cell towers. So, yeah, it'll go through the building, but then it won't travel as much through open space. So 6 to 1, half a dozen of the other.
Join X.
Yes.
That gentleman with the HOA problem, can you get to your gutters on your house, and are they aluminum or they're plastic? If they are, you can run RG6U straight up to the end of the gutter, hook it up, and you'll have the shielding from the coax. That you don't attach that, you just leave that, you know, you cut it so it's like an end-fed long wire, and then you hook that to a tuner.
Okay, yeah, I don't really have access to the gutters. They put a cover over them. I'm not really sure. If I would do something like that, I'd probably have to do it at night. I'm not sure if it's worth it. I could run the cable up behind the leader and into the gutter system, but I'm not sure if that would really be okay for me to do.
Well, then maybe you can just run a wire just on the top of it and work it that way.
All right, I'll look at multiple friends here and the advice of some really good people. I was able to figure out that I could actually put in a 40-meter dipole. The thing is, it is right up against the building. If the building's an old construction. It's like 50 years old, so it's all wood and very little metal. It was all wood and brick, so, you know, we'll see what happens. I'm kind of stuck with what I have.
Roger. Okay. Well, drop me an email on QRZ. It's Kilo Delta 2 India November X-ray, and we'll figure something out.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much. And, George, yeah, that's the whole concept of compromised antennas. You kind of look around your environment and you try and do the best you can with what the universe has given you.
Understood, yep. I'm always looking to learn more, though. I appreciate the input and the information. That pretty much answers my questions that I have right now. Q. 82VCQ.
Okay, very good, George. You're always welcome to come back and share some discoveries or ask any questions that pop up. I wish you well.
Thank you, Roy. Always a pleasure, and I really do appreciate that. This is George, KD2VCQ.
Okay, very good. Once again, I'll call out if anyone has any radio questions before we shift gears with the science portion of the tactical net. Anyone with any questions or comments or topics, you give me your name and your call sign.
NY2H, Lou.
Yes, Lou.
All right, maybe this will segue from radio to science, kind of bridge it. I don't know if you heard that, but the media now is, or some governmental agencies, scientific agencies, coming back with regard to that Cuba syndrome, where the diplomats were getting headaches and hearing sounds, etc. We talked about that a while back, and I think Dick was around and involved in the discussions, and some people were positing microwave energy, some people were positing mass hysteria. Seems like they're going with the microwave energy again and pulsed microwave, high energy microwave, with some background into some of the weapons that have been developed in the past, et cetera, et cetera. So there's some more news coming out on that. I don't know if you're aware of that yet. So back to that.
Yeah, Lou, even though I don't really read too many articles anymore now that I'm doing TechNet, I always make up a list, and number one on my list of science articles was U.S. diplomats' brain injuries may be from covert microwave attacks, experts said. So the problem is that this is not a fundamental kind of a solution to the problem. This is a bunch of scientists who were given the task of trying to figure out what it possibly could be. And they sort of went with basically the Frey effect, which is that pulse microwaves can have detrimental effects to cellular biology. No proof, but that's their sensibility. Now, if you ask a bunch of basically electrical engineers, physicists, and physiologists, you'll probably never get the psychiatric answer. So they didn't really give a reason for discounting hysteria, and I've heard interviews with people. There was, after this, there was yet another case, apparently, in Russia, where the CIA agent basically retired, and he took a great deal of offense, feeling that people basically said that he was crazy. You know, group mass hysteria is not really being crazy. It happens to perfectly sane people. It's an interesting cognitive flaw to the human mind. So I'm still on that side. Dick was on the other side. He had heard a 60 Minutes article, a episode on 60 Minutes, and he was taken with their arguments. But to me, it's still up in the air.
All right, yep, yeah, so all right, we'll see, maybe we won't, but they did, you know, provide, I believe, some background as to the state of the art, and, you know, so things out there that do exist, but that's it. I didn't dig deeply into it either, but figured, you know, we've been kicking it around, and we'll see. All righty, that's it. Thank you. NY2H.
You're welcome, Lou. Like I said, great minds think alike. I pulled that as a possible discussion point. Also, probably for next week, there's an interesting article on the subject of why, you know, we had this discussion of if there's an almost infinite number of stars out in the outer space, why isn't outer space bright white instead of black? So there's a story that shines a little light on that subject as well. I thought I would leave that for next Sunday night's a top slot, if I ever get to any of these slots.
KV2, excuse me, Jose.
Yes. PB, I didn't catch the entire call sign.
Kilo, Delta 2, Quebec, Papa Victor, Jose, saying hi and listening to the net.
Oh, okay, very good. Hello, Jose. Last we spoke, it was on 10 meters in the morning.
Yes, Roy. I went upstairs to the roof. I took down the beam antenna was full of water, and the cable was corrupted, so I'm planning to change everything.
Oh, that's a shame. Yeah, so water and electronics don't go together too well. But so I look forward to having a more significant conversation with you on 10 meters in future Sundays. Jose is one of the many people who has joined the Kings County Radio Club 10 Meter Net. We're there every Sunday morning at 11 o'clock, even Andy, WA2CDL, passed by and said hello. So if you got 10-meter capability and you want to chat, we're there at 28.380 upper sideband every Sunday morning at 11 a.m. We go on until about 12:30, 1 o'clock.
2BCQ.
Yes, George.
See, I did have one more question. When I'm building this antenna, I used monster wire, speaker wire. Does it matter what you use for the element, or should I use something different?
No, Monster Wire is fine. It's probably a bit overpriced for the purpose. All that you want is a decent conductive material. The best conductive material for the price, I said for the price, so the guy out there is going to tell me that silver is more conductive than copper, is copper. So you could have either solid copper, you can have stranded copper, you could have copper with insulation, which is a little bit more protective. You can have bare copper, and if you are really obsessive compulsive and you want it to have a higher tensile strength, copper is a ductile metal. It's a bendable and stretchable metal. So to kind of get rid of that, they make something called copper-clad steel wire, which is basically a core of steel, and then it is wrapped in the copper. The trick with the radio frequency currents is that they exist on the skin of the conductor, not in the core, and so the fact that there is less, more highly resistant steel at the core is immaterial. It's going through the highly low-resistant copper surface. But your choice was just as good.
Does the gauge matter at all?
The gauge matters more for the power carrying capacity. If you have an infinitesimally small diameter conducting wire and you run too much current through it, because as the surface, even though it's a skin effect, if you decrease the diameter, the circumference gets less and less, and so the resistance gets more and more, and it can heat up and melt and go away. So a higher, thicker gauge wire will sustain more current without any kind of damage. There is a very slight benefit to a very, very thick piece of wire or hollow tubing. If you make the outer diameter very large, you basically decrease the Q of the tuned circuit of the antenna, and you increase the bandwidth that it's resonant to. So you need less of antenna tuner power if you have a very, very, very large diameter radiating conductor. The problems with that is to make it significant would be to make it very expensive and mechanically a big pain in the backside. So no one kind of does that. You see that with cage antennas, in which you don't need to have a solid surface. You could have just a mesh network, and that serves the same purpose as far as radio waves are concerned. They see it as a solid surface, but those are few and far between.
Thank you. That answered my question. Thank you, Roy.
You're welcome. Once again, if anyone else has a radio technology question, let me know, and give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, so we will move on to the science portion of the technical net. And Wesley wanted to make some comments. So, Wesley, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Okay, you're on.
Thank you very much, and actually a physical phenomenon that I'm going to touch here very much known. It's a confirmed it's not a theory, and it's commercially used. At a certain point of my speech, we're going to see something, or we're going to note something that my shark hound people, probably Dr. Roy will have his own comments. So I'm going to touch a standing wave, traveling wave, and phenomena we related to light lasers. I have sent to Dr. Roy two emails. One is the absolutely educated from millimeters to femto lasers, and the other one was polaritron versus surface plasma. I'm not sure if Dr. Roy was able to view it, but because the ability of Dr. Roy with his excellent skills to explain things, I would ask gently Dr. Roy to give you words about how the light is converted to the laser. And if you were able to see the emails, what are the applications? There is also one specific moment in here, and that's the two mirrors. Dr. Roy.
Yeah, I didn't get a chance to run through all of the YouTubes, and one of them you sent me, it's 7:40, and, you know, that's kind of tight for me. If you want me to, I'll do a little pitter-patter on what lasers is and how they work.
Definitely. Please do so.
Okay, well, lasers, I think they were invented in the early 60s, light amplification through simulated emission of radiation. Fancy bunch of words. Basically, it is a light source that is both spatially and temporally coherent, meaning that the different electromagnetic waves are all in lockstep and in phase with each other. So when one electromagnetic wave is at its crest, all the other in that space are at their crest as well. And usually it's spatially coherent as well. That's why it has a very, very narrow spot emission, and the spread is not as great as most light sources. So coherency is a big thing, both spatial and phase-related coherency. The way that you do it is relatively simple. Different materials can be pumped. Their electrons can be pumped to higher energy levels using different methods of stimulating the electrons. And then, if you leave them go, eventually they will drop down to their ground state. And because of conservation of energy, they have to give off a photon. If you then sandwich this material that's being pumped up in a cylindrical housing with a 100% mirror on one end and a 50% mirror on the other end, what you get is these photons will go down to the mirror, bounce off, they'll go across the cylinder and strike energized atoms. Those atoms will be stimulated to drop down to ground state, emit their photons in the same phase. It'll go to the other end, hit the mirror, and it goes back and forth, and it becomes an optical resonant cavity. But one side is only 50% mirrored, so sometimes the photons go through and sometimes they bounce back. And that's what pumps the laser, and the output can be red, it could be infrared, it could be ultraviolet, it could be any range of the electromagnetic wave spectrum. So that, in a short term, is light amplification from stimulation of emitted radiation.
Beautiful. Thank you very much for that. We're going further with that and start from the staff, and that would be standing wave. Definition, ratio, example, and explanation. Standing wave is one that is formed by combination of two waves moving in opposite directions by having equal frequency and amplitude. But actually, it's not two waves, it's one wave. So it's one wave that is bouncing the same way as Dr. Roy was explaining. The only thing is that in standing wave, we don't have the mirrors that differ between themselves. They are exactly the same. If Dr. Roy would be kind enough to give additional explanation to the standing wave and to X-ray.
I think what you're presenting is, rather than the description for the laser, this is going on a planar surface.
Yeah, that's a tricky part. I didn't go that year there yet. I'm trying to explain that the normal understanding of the standing wave, and then go to the traveling wave. Well, the steady wave can only be formed when the wave motion is restricted with the given finite space. In more specific terms, a standing wave is a wave that oscillates in time, but its peak amplitude profile doesn't move in space. If Dr. Roy would be kind enough to give to it more easy to understand the form and structure.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of YouTube that have a lot of demonstrations of wave phenomena, and they can demonstrate when you send a signal back and forth against the reflective surface, and it has resonance and it reinforces itself, and it's a standing wave. I mean, in general speaking, 99% of the antennas that amateur radio operators use are standing wave antennas, standing wave radiators. I think Wes is going to touch upon traveling waves. There are a few antennas that use that principle, such as beverage antennas. But 99.9% of all of our radiating or receiving antennas are standing wave devices.
Yeah, so the wave travels from point A to B, and then because point A and B is alike, then it bounces back. And then we have, when we have a mismatch of impedance at the end of the coaxial cable as well. But now, at that point, we're really dealing with TEM, a wave that has two significant modes, and those modes are transverse magnetic and transverse electric. But we're not going to go there. We're not going to have it that complicated. Let me jump. But anyhow, in the traveling wave, a wave transmits energy from one point to the other. Dr. Roy, could you give some more words about traveling wave? Because we want to signify the difference between standing wave and traveling wave.
Well, you know, as I mentioned before, I think the antenna that most people are aware of, that's a traveling wave, is a beverage antenna. Those are rather long antennas and low gain. Instead of setting up resonance where the wave goes back and forth across the conductor, it just travels out to, in the case of a beverage wave, a simple resistor, and the excess energy is dissipated in heat.
Thank you very much. Now, a little bit more difficult. We have two terms. One is plasmon, and the other one is polaritron. Plasmon is a quantum of plasma oscillation, just as a light and optical oscillation. You got to understand that the waves that we're transmitting right now are exactly the same electromagnetic wave as the optical waves at very short wavelength. Light is electromagnetic. Let me go. So just light consists of photons, and if we have a plasma oscillation, then we have plasmons in the plasma. There is another term, which is polaritron, and we're trying to understand what is the difference between them and what is polaritron. It would be very much difficult to understand a description. In physics, polaritrons are quasi-particles resulting from strong coupling of electromagnetic wave with electric or magnetic dipole carrying excitation. The thing is that when we have a laser, we have two mirrors, and Dr. Roy, you were able to see that 20 seconds part of that video. It was showing the movement between two mirrors, and then we have the excited electrons there, and those electrons are actually plasmons, and then if we put something in between them, that could be some form of germanium or whatever the plate would be. We creating in the, and the light still passes through it. We creating a polaritron in there. And if Dr. Roy would be able to give easy to understand explanation for polaritron.
Wesley, I wish I could give you a simple explanation for a polaritron. I posted a link to the Wikipedia, and you know, I would suggest people who are curious look it up. It's a bit on the esoteric side. Plasmons, I think you kind of alluded to the fact that plasmons are electrons. Not exactly. They're sort of like photons, but they're actually described as quasi particles. You know, lots of luck explaining to the average person what a quasi particle is.
Well, I don't know how to, but okay, let me try. Polaritron, a fast piece, true base, arcade. That would be not that. Not that. I'm trying to think how could explain polaritron. But anyhow. In lasers, we deal with polaritrons, but also in a little bit deeper part of physics, we deal with plasma, and when we deal with plasma, then we deal with plasma. And then we have something like surface, plasmon, polaritron. So it would be like two things together. In that video that you saw, the polaritron was explained like half mass and half photon. Do you recall that?
No, I do not. But I mean, that's sort of what's at the problem with quasi particles. You know, some things are relatively simple to explain to the average person that hasn't read a quantum mechanics book. And some aren't. And the concept of something that's part of one particle and part of another thing is problematic. I mean, you could basically read the explanation on Wikipedia, and I think everyone would agree that they don't have the faintest idea what it means, because it uses terms that don't usually go together, you know, like electromagnetic waves and dielectric surfaces and charges and motion on metal surfaces. It's real blue sky stuff.
Well, if I was to name that thing, a thing, use the word thing, surface plasmon polaritron is the fundamental thing, whereas surface plasmon resonance is the state of that surface plasmon polaritron. The effect is observed to the presence of fundamental things. So, surface plasmon, polaritron, and surface plasmon resonance is not the same. And the reason that I'm touching it is because surface plasmon polaritrons are electromagnetic waves that travel along the metal dielectric and metal air interface. Now, if we look at that interface and we put a metal and put dielectric on that metal, we don't see the space. For our eyes, it might look like there are two different things that are touching each other, but for electromagnetic wave, it is an interface. If we look at interfaces, we may say that waveguides are interfaces as well. One of the biggest interfaces in the world is Schumann waveguide, and that's the sort of big interface that has plasma on the top, and the other boundary of it is Earth, and it's definitely not two-dimensional. let's concentrate for a moment on two-dimensional space. So let's say we have a waveguide that is now flat, and now we have dielectric, and we have conducting matter. The space, the two-dimensional space between those structures is a perfect interface or perfect waveguide for the electromagnetic wave at a certain conditions. So if we decided to touch the surface plasmon polaritron, because at the Brewster angle, that polaritron could actually enter to that waveguide, to that interface, two dimensional, without reflection or refraction. But Dr. Roy, you could explain a typical experiment where you have a stream of water that is flowing from the bucket, and then we try to shoot the laser beam into it, and then we see that the laser beam is trapped in that water. Could you explain that to the audience?
Well, I mean, it's basically what you just said. It's you can have transmission of electromagnetism as a surface phenomenon, and I realize you're fascinated by surface waves, and this is an example. Whether you can extrapolate that interaction in small laboratory experiments and do it on, say, the surface of the ocean is sort of dubious as far as I'm aware.
KD2FIU.
Yes, George.
Early waveguide development and later waveguide development are two different principles. And one is a square wave concept through an original coax, and one is a later principle through an actual light fiber spectrum.
No, we're not talking about that. We're not touching traveling light in the waveguide, such as fiber optic, a fiber optic, yes, it traps the light, but that light is not delivered under the Brewster angle. Brewster was was physicist who discovered that light at given angle doesn't refract and doesn't reflect. It simply enters with 100% of its energy into the interface, and that interface is two-dimensional. Dr. Roy.
KD2FIU.
Yes, George, one second. I just want to point out that if you go to Wikipedia and you go to roy.ac2gs.com, and I'll give you the link to the Wikipedia article if you're so inclined. There's no mention of Brewster angle there, but George, you wanted to say something.
I'm not sure why this concept was not used earlier, as mentioned, as it was in the early part of the 20th century. I missed that. But the whole concept of a light transmission over a medium, this is not all fitting right with me because I was part of the development.
Yes, I don't want to step on what Wesley's planning to take us, but I think the two of you are talking about different things. He tends to focus on the surface interface, and it's purely a surface phenomena, whereas most fiber optics is not a surface situation, but a three-dimensional one dealing with refraction and such. So I think you're talking about two separate things, personally.
KD2FIU?
Yes, George.
Negative. This is what I'm saying. It's the square wave on the surface versus the light wave through the fiber optic. And I'm challenging all of this.
Okay, it's your right to challenge it. I don't have a clue where this is going. I just don't consider optics, light wave, light pipe, fiber optical phenomena to be a solely surface phenomena, but more of a three-dimensional one. But perhaps I am wrong.
You're not wrong. The thing is that for many professionals, a surface wave in the interface is very much unknown. But that science is practically, technically, and commercially used right now. If we say that we have in the electromagnetic wave in the certain medium, that would be the coaxial cable, but that could be also the fiber optic, and that could exist as a TEM, transverse electromagnetic. And then this transverse electromagnetic has two modes. One of them is transverse electric, and the other one is transverse electromagnetic. The thing is that when a surface plasma polaritron enters without refraction or reflection, simply slid itself into the interface that is two-dimensional, then we're dealing with transverse magnetic mode, and then there is no losses. Now, there is a strange thing that is happening, that the inverse square law acts a little bit differently on two-dimensional space and on three-dimensional space, and that's a major difference between fiber optic. And that's what I'm talking about.
Okay. Again, don't really know the specifics on that. I know your great affection for surface wave phenomena and the fact that it's lossless. I have numerous problems with that. It sort of depends upon the geometry. If you keep it in a waveguide, then you don't have the usual losses, but if you put it in three-dimensional space, you're going to have, even if you keep it at two dimensions, you're still going to have 1 over R. You know, if it's three-dimensional space, then you're going to have 1 over R squared. So I'm not quite sure how it's going to be lossless.
Let me make you a little bit more confused. And it's going to be a problem, but I love to have a problematic subject with you, Dr. Roy, and I do appreciate your pounding on it. I love you being against. Okay, so we have surface plasma polaritrons, and then we have electromagnetic waves, and then we have a longitudinal wave, and we have transverse wave. So most of us knows what is transverse wave, what is electromagnetic wave, and the raw electromagnetic wave is transverse wave, but longitudinal wave is not. Is it true? Let me continue. So, there is one certain example of electromagnetic wave that is longitudinal. And it's physics, Dr. Roy. You can fight with it, you're not going to win. So, surface wave polaritron electromagnetic waves that travel along magnetic metal dielectric or metal air interface or dielectric interface where two dielectrics differ between themselves. So, in order for you to make two-dimensional space where electromagnetic wave could travel in transverse magnetic mode, TM mode, we need to have an interface. So practically, in the infrared or visible frequency, we have no problems to do so. Let me drop. So, in surface plasmon polaritrons, the surface charge density waves which can propagate along the metal dielectric interface, if we take metal dielectric interface in a metallic nanoparticle opposite to propagating surface plasma polaritron along the flat surface. So the problem that we have in those high frequencies is that the surface is supposed to be flat. So two-dimensional interface should be flat. And now, Because longitude and all waves are waves which the displacement of the medium is the same, in the same direction as the opposite direction to the direction of propagation of wave, then we're dealing with mostly mechanical longitudinal waves. They're also called compressional or compression waves because they produce compression and refraction, refraction when traveling through the medium as pressure waves. Then